This message is a presentation of Pinnacle Baptist Church and the preaching ministry of Pastor Ray McBerry. Other messages like this are available online at pinnaclebaptist.com. The church is located at 2517 High Falls Road in Griffin, Georgia. If you're in the area, we would love for you to visit us this Sunday. Now, here's today's message.
Well, tonight we're back in the book of Genesis. We're in chapter number 13. We are studying the life of Abraham now, and it will take up a good portion of the rest of the book of Genesis. And over these next several chapters in the book of Genesis, we're particularly going to be concerned with Abraham and his nephew Lot. We'll see Lot as a central character over these next few chapters. And there are, I guess we all are familiar with the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, but there's some other things related to Lot in the story of Lot that have some very practical applications for our own lives as well. We're going to see some of that tonight. And so I think it'll be a blessing as we go through. As I mentioned this morning, you know, we want to always, as a former teacher, I love the academic side of just teaching the Word of God. But as I think any good preacher, he ought to include some teaching with his preaching. But if he doesn't include some preaching with the teaching, then he's missing out, and you're missing out as well. So I think there'll be some good knowledge type things that you'll enjoy, maybe some things you've never seen before, even if you've studied the book of Genesis. But I hope there will be some practical things that you and I see that will help us in our Christian lives as we seek to walk with the Lord. So here we are, Genesis chapter 13. You remember we finished chapter 12, which was 2 weeks ago in our Bible study, where Abram and Sarai were down in Egypt. Abram had lied he had convinced Sarai to lie about the fact that he said, just tell them you're my sister so they don't kill me because they want to marry you. And it's true, she was his sister. She's his half-sister. We'll see that again later on in the book of Genesis. She's his half-sister, so that wasn't untrue, but she was married to him. And so he put his wife in jeopardy, their marriage situation in jeopardy, and he also put Pharaoh and the Egyptians in jeopardy because Pharaoh thought she was unmarried, eligible, and he was already making plans for her to be married to him and had already taken steps in that direction. I will say this past week as I was studying for tonight's Bible study, I did run across a Bible commentator that I like, I enjoy, and he actually had something good to say about Abram in that situation down in Egypt that I hadn't really thought about before. He said, for all the bad things we could say about Abram, we might also need to mention the fact that it was the custom in that day and time that if a man wanted to divorce his wife, it was fairly easy for a man to just divorce his wife if he wanted to. He could pretty much just say, I'm divorcing her, and that was it. And the only time that you really could not do that is if there was a child already produced from the marriage. It was not necessarily that easy for a wife to divorce the husband, but the husband could pretty much divorce his wife anytime he wanted to. And what the point was, the commentator was making, is that Abram, in order to get out of this sticky situation when they went down to Egypt, he could have just simply divorced Sarai and walked away from the whole thing. He didn't do that. He stayed, he stayed in the marriage relationship. He certainly was not doing what was honorable, but at least he didn't divorce her. So I just throw that out there for what it's worth. That was one thought that I had not thought of myself that one particular Bible commentator mentioned in Abram's defense. I don't think we want to try to defend the other things he did in that chapter, though. All right, Genesis chapter number 13, beginning in verse 1. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the south. All right, I'm going to stop right here. First of all, it's telling us now we're continuing with the story. And he's going to go up out of Egypt. The Bible says he went out of Egypt into the south. Now, if he's going back to the land of Canaan, you know, he's going northward. But when it says that he went into the south, what that's telling us is he's talking about the southern part of the land of Canaan. TR, am I a little bit too hot? Maybe it sounds to me like I may be echoing just a little bit. Anybody else hearing that? Or is it just the preacher? Okay, it's just the preacher. All right. So they went out of Egypt to the south. And so it's talking about the southern part of Canaan down here. This desert area between the land of Canaan and the land of Egypt. It says here that he went, his wife, his nephew Lot, and all that he had with him. He leaves Egypt, by all accounts, a richer man than he was when they went down to Egypt. Remember Pharaoh thinking that he was just Sarai's brother, and Pharaoh wanting to court Sarai, he was giving Abraham cattle and gold and silver and all this stuff. So Abraham's down there. He's getting rich while Pharaoh's trying to court his wife. So when he leaves Egypt, Pharaoh basically says, listen, just take everything you got and get out of here. And so he leaves Egypt, even though he was certainly not doing something honorable. We see, I think, a fulfillment, a continuing fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, where God said that he was going to bless Abram. I'm still hearing that, TR. Would you back me down just a little bit, please? God said he would bless Abram and make of him a great nation. And here's Abram. He's not doing the honorable thing, but God's still blessing him. He's blessing Abram not just for Abram's sake, but he's blessing Abram for his seed's sake, his descendants' sake, to come after Abram, and ultimately for our sake as well, since we know the Messiah is going to come through his lineage. I think it's just a reminder to us that that Abrahamic covenant that we spent a whole week talking about, it was an unconditional covenant that God made with Abram. It was not predicated on Abram doing what he was supposed to do, even though he should have done what he was supposed to do. But even when he was out of God's will, not doing what he should do, God's still blessing the man. And he's blessing him for other people's sake as well as Abram's sake. But the Bible says he, Sarai, and Lot, with all that he had, went into the south. So they're the southern part of Canaan here. Now, note here that Lot was with them. We know Lot had been with them ever since they left Haran. Here's Haran up near this part in Syria. And you know the rest of the map. I'm not going to go over all the geographical features of the map. You've seen this map quite a few times. I will ask this as a question, because I told some of them before you got here, Alex. Alex, I know you know the answer to this, so I'm going to ask you, what's the name of this island up here below Turkey? It's the same island that Barnabas was from in the New Testament. Cyprus. See, he got it right. I knew Alex would get that one right. Thank you, Alex. All right, so I point that out, that Lot was with them, because Lot is still continuing to journey with Abram and Sarai, and he has been down to Egypt. He, like Abram, has seen the good things down in Egypt, the material things of Egypt, the fatness of the land, so to speak. He's seen how the land along the Nile River was so fertile, so lush, and it was a place to be desired. So Lot has seen the same places that Abram has seen. I say that because it's kind of setting up what we're about to see happen in the story of Abram and Lot. Verse 2, and Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai. Remember, Hai is the same as the small town that Joshua encountered when they came into the promised land later. Hai, same town. So the city of Jerusalem would be somewhere right about here, where I've put a star on the map. But of course, at this particular junction in time, it's not referred to, it's not called Jerusalem, it's simply called by what name? Well, it's called Salem, Salem of the Jebus, the Jebusites. So it's just Salem at this point, but Milton's right. And then Bethel would be in the mountains to the north. I don't know if you can see this small dot. But Bethel would be in the mountains to the north of Jerusalem. And then Ai was just a little bit to the east of Bethel. So you got these two places up here. That's what we're talking about. They're to the north of Jerusalem. Bethel, we've seen this. We've talked about the name. What does the name Bethel mean? The house of God. That's right. Beth meaning house. El, the name for God. House of God. Bethel. We've seen that when he was there before, he called on the name of the Lord. He built an altar there to worship the Lord. And so here he is now. He's up there between, in the mountains, between Bethel and Ai. Verse 4, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and there Abram called on the name of the Lord. That is, he's worshiping God. When it says he called on the name of the Lord, that's what it means. He's worshiping the Lord. Verse 5, and Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. So he's in business for himself. He's learning from his uncle Abram. I'm supposing that Lot probably inherited whatever had been his daddy's before his daddy passed away up here in Haran while they were journeying. He probably inherited whatever that his father had, maybe from his uncle also that had passed away. So he's in business. He has his own flocks and herds as well. Verse 6 says, and the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together. For their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. This is simply saying that the two men, Abram and Lot, had so many head of cattle, flocks of sheep, that there wasn't room for all of the animals to graze together. There were too many animals for the land there. And, of course, trying to keep them separated, that's a whole different issue as well. And both of them, having so many animals, they both had servants that worked for them that were taking care of the animals. So there's a controversy now that erupts between those working for Lot and those working for Abram, and they're in conflict with each other because they're both trying to do a good job for whoever their master is, and now there's a confrontation that's brewing. Verse number 7, and there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. So Abram and Lot are here in the what we would think of as basically the central part of Israel today. They have so many head of cattle and sheep and whatnot that there's not enough grazing land really for all their animals, but they're not even the ones who own the land in a technical sense, in a legal sense at this point. Now, you and I know that God has promised all of this land to Abram and to his seed, but at this point, there are other people living there who consider it their land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. The Perizzites, I believe, are probably just an offshoot, one of the family branches off the Canaanites themselves. But they're living in the land, and they consider the land theirs. And now here are these nomads, Abram and Lot, coming in with all their cattle, bringing all their animals too, and there just wasn't enough grazing land for the area where they were. Verse 8, and Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Zoar would have been down here on the way to Egypt. It's still down here in the wilderness. And so what the Bible is telling us here is that Abram said, listen, Lot, there's no reason that we ought to have an argument between the two of us over these head of cattle and who's going to graze where. He said, lest there be a problem, you go one direction, I'll go the other direction. Now, because Abram is, in all likelihood, the elder of the two, and he certainly has the position of authority over Lot, no matter what their ages were, in that he's Lot's uncle, he is the patriarch of the family still at this point, now that his father has died, and Lot's father has died, and Lot's uncle has died. Abram's the patriarch of the family. So in all fairness, Abram could have said, listen, I'm going to tell you where I'm going to go, and you go the other way. It would have been fair, would have been just, would have been right. But Abram didn't do that. Abram was the bigger man, and he said, I tell you what, Lot, I'll just let you choose. You choose where you want to go, and I'll go the opposite direction. Now, I want you to look at the map with me for just a moment. Where they're standing here, we're just going to kind of draw a dotted line across the map of Israel there. Now, as they were standing there looking toward the plains of Jordan, that area near the Jordan River, he said, you go to the left hand, and I'll go to the right hand. Or if you'd rather, you go to the right hand, and I'll go to the left hand. What he was saying to Lot is, you take the northern part of the land that God has promised to me, and I'll take the southern part, or we'll do it the other way around. So the north or the south, you choose, Lot. So he's given Lot the choice. Lot, he didn't have to give Lot the choice. He could have made the choice himself, but he lets Lot choose. So being Lot, you would suppose he would choose one or the other of what Abram told him to choose from. That's not what he did. Let's read on and look at the choice that Lot made. Verse 11. By the way, before we go there, look at verse 10. It says, Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld the plain of Jordan, all the plain of Jordan. Lot is not looking to the north or to the south. Lot is only looking at that fertile land along the Jordan River. Why? I think because, as the Bible says, it was well watered at this point. This is before God's destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain down there. So it's still very lush, very green. The Bible even says, even as the garden of the Lord. What place is that? The Garden of Eden, that's right. This must have been some more kind of lush, green, fertile land before God destroyed the cities of the plain with Sodom and Gomorrah a few chapters later. It also says, like the land of Egypt. So Lot had been with Abram down to Egypt. He had seen the beautiful land there. He had seen how rich everybody there was in comparison to everybody else because of living along the Nile River. So he looks to the Jordan River, sees everything so green, and instead of choosing the left or the right, he says, I'm going that way. He said, basically, I want everything along the Jordan River. I want everything along the plain that accompanies the river. Verse 11, then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan. And Lot journeyed to the north? Nope. To the south? Nope. Lot journeyed east. And they separated themselves, the one from the other. Boy, Lot really took advantage of the situation. He didn't look to the north nor to the south. He said, I want that. I want all the good stuff. That was a selfish decision, no matter how you look at it. He wanted all the good for himself. He was taking advantage of the fact that his uncle had given him the opportunity to choose. He said, I'll just go that way. Verse 12. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. Now, we already know the reputation of Sodom and Gomorrah. We haven't gotten to that story. We'll get to that story, but we're not the only ones that know the reputation of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot And Abram also knew the reputation of the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. When Lot looked towards the plain of Jordan, where those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were located, he said, I want that. That's the best. I want that. I'm going that way. He already knew that the cities along the plain of Jordan were full of wicked people. In reality, they kind of matched up with Lot himself, perhaps in some regard. He was selfish in making the choice to go that way himself. And he was going right after the same kind of people that he was following after, and that is materialistic, only looking for those things of this world. And so that's why he looked that way. Now, I've heard a preacher long ago when I was a teenager preach a message out of verse number 12. It says, and he pitched his tent toward Sodom. And the message that the preacher was preaching back then was that, listen, Lot was in trouble a long time before he ever got led out of Sodom and Gomorrah by the hand by that angel. We already could see that he was headed for destruction, headed for doom, headed for misery when he pitched his tent toward Sodom. That is, he set his tent up so that he could look out the front of his tent and see Sodom, the city of Sodom, down there in the valley, on the plain. You see, before Lot ever made it to Sodom, his heart was already there. There's a good message there. I think that'll preach, Brother John. His heart was already there. You know, in our own Christian lives, we have to be careful too of where our heart is. And a lot of times we can stop and just kind of take a measurement of where we are spiritually by where our heart is, where our affections are. I'll never forget, I've mentioned this before, those of you that were here, one of the things that my youth pastor said one Wednesday night in that upstairs room with a bunch of teenagers, he said, I could go into the parking lot right now, turn your car radio on, and I could tell you where you are spiritually in your life with the Lord based on what's on your radio. Now, of course, all the teenagers got upset and they said, you're not going down there and get in my car and turn my radio on, you know, whatever. And some of them said, oh, you can't tell anything about me by what's on the radio. But, you know, the more I got to thinking about that, I think my youth pastor was probably onto something. And, you know, it's not the pastor's job to follow you around during the week, and I'm not going to do that, wouldn't do that. But I wonder if you just thought about, over the course of a week, what your radio is on during the week, what you watch on TV, what you listen to on the radio, I wonder if there wasn't some truth to what my youth pastor was saying. You know, where our affections are, where our attention is, that probably, to a large degree, gives a pretty accurate barometer of where our heart is spiritually. I think that's the same thing that he was saying here, Moses is saying here when he records this about Lot, that he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Why? Because his heart was already there. All right, verse 14. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thine eyes and look from the place where thou art, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So the Lord is reaffirming the promise he's made to Abram about the land itself. That all the land, as far as he could see, to the north, to the south, to the east, and to the west, is going to be given to Abram and to his seed forever. The Bible says he told Abram to go walk through the land. It's kind of like surveying your property. I know where I live now, moved down there 18 years ago. and I've got 12 acres. I never in a million years thought I'd own 12 acres. Brother John, don't tell me how many you own, because then I'll covet, and so don't tell me. But when I first bought the land, the first thing I did is I just drove down there and started walking, just because I wanted to see the property that was mine. Well, that's what the Lord's telling Abram to do. Just take off, go walking, because all that you see, all that you walk on is going to be yours and your seeds. That was in that day and time. That was one day of actually laying claim to land. Now, remember, there are still other people living there who they view this land as belonging to them because they were there before Abram arrived. God didn't tell them this belongs to Abram, so they still view it as theirs. There's going to be a little bit of a discomforted, uncomfortable situation later on when the descendants of Abram come back to possess the land, because those other people think they ought to possess the land. But God said, this is your land. He's reaffirming the promise that he made to Abram. And it says that Abram removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron. Now, Hebron is actually the highest point in Israel, as I understand it. It's about 3,000 feet above sea level, and it's to the south of the city of Jerusalem. It's in the mountains down here. It's the place, by the way, we see later on when the children of Israel go into the land to possess it. One particular man claimed Hebron for his own inheritance. Who is the children of Israel? Who was the man that said, I want that mountain? Caleb, that's right. The one who had gone with Joshua 40 years earlier to spy out the land.
He was
85 years old, and he and his boys just charged up the mountain and fought the giants that lived up on top of Mount Hebron, the Anakim, as they were called. Anyway, that's the place where Abram was. He's now journeyed. He's to the south of what is today the city of Jerusalem. All right, now that brings us to the end of chapter 13. I probably should stop here, but I'm not going to do that. We're going to go ahead and launch off into chapter 14. So here we go, verse 1. And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedar Laomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shimber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. So it's telling us here that there are some kings of the east over here in the land of Mesopotamia who make war with these kings of these city-states here in the land of Canaan, including the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. By the way, the names of the two kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, Bera and Birsha, the root word of both their names means wicked. So that tells you a little bit about these men. Their names themselves mean wicked. These are wicked kings, wicked men. But those kings to the east, in Mesopotamia, there's Amraphel, king of Shinar. You remember the name Shinar? We've already seen it earlier in the book of Genesis. What do we know about Shinar? Where is it? What is it? What's that? That's right. The city of the Tower of Babel was built, the Bible says, on the plain of Shinar. Shinar was this fertile plain right around the Euphrates River, where the Tower of Babel and later the city of Babylon would be built. So that's where that is. It says Arioch of Elasar. I can't tell you exactly where Elasar is, except that it's somewhere in Mesopotamia. It says Chedor Laomer, king of Elam. The Elamites lived to the east over here, and the Elamites were some of the people that make up what is today the country of Iran. So here you have Iraq, Iran, side by side. The Elamites would have been some of the early ancestors of those that are in Iran today. And then it says, in title, king of nations. the best that I can come up with from all the digging that I did to try to find out where this king's kingdom was is that one of two choices. He either was a Hittite king from up here in Anatolia, Turkey, or perhaps he was a king from the land of Edom, which is down here where the modern-day country of Jordan is located, but still to the east of the land of Canaan. Nevertheless, these kings unite together. They come, and they basically take over the land of Canaan. Look what it says in verse 3. All these were joined together in the vale, that's a valley, of Siddim, which is the Salt Sea. So apparently they all came together to do battle around the Dead Sea down here in the southern part of the land of Canaan. That's nine kings in all, I believe, if I added them correctly. Verse 4, 12 years they served Chedor Laomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. So basically those kings of the east came in, conquered the land of Canaan, and forced the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities in the land of Canaan to pay them tribute every year. They didn't keep their cities or anything. They let them stay where they were, but they had to pay a tribute every year to the Elamite king. And as long as they paid their tribute 12 years in a row, everything was fine, hunky-dory. But in the 13th year, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain said, nope, no more. We're not paying anymore. We're done. They rebelled. And in the 14th year came Chedor Laomer and the kings that were with him and smote the Rephaims in Ashtaroth Karnaim and the Zuzims in Ham and the Emans in Shava Kirithaim and the Horites in their Mount Seir unto Elparan, which is by the wilderness. And they returned and came to in Mishpat, which is Kadesh, and smote all the country of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites that dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. So it's basically telling us that when the kings of the plains rebelled, all these kings from the east came over with their armies and said, we'll put down this rebellion, and you'll go back to paying your tribute. And it says they basically, they conquered all of this area where the cities of the plains were, all the way down here to the coast, even to this desert area, and below Hebron. Now the Rephaim, we see later in the Old Testament, the Zuzims and the Emans, we see mention of those later on, and it seems from some of the passages that we see later on in the Old Testament, that these are referring either to literal giants, like the Anakim that lived up on Mount Hebron, or at the very least, these were men that were known for their mighty prowess. The name Rephaim literally means those that are respected. Some Bible commentators say it even seems to refer to those that are come back from the dead, that are the quote-unquote the gods of these people. I'm sure these are men, but perhaps like the Anakim who lived up on Mount Hebron and others of the Amorites, these are perhaps giants. But the kings of the east come over and they basically mop the floor with these Amorites that live there in the land of Canaan. Verse number 8. And there went out the king of Sodom and the king of Gomorrah and the king of Admah and the king of Zeboam and the king of Bela, the same as Zoar, and they joined battle with them in the vale of Siddim. Again, that's the Dead Sea. With Chedor Laomer, the king of Elam, and with Tidal, king of nations, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings with five. That's quite a battle. And the vale of Siddim was full of slime pits. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell there. And they that remained fled to the mountain. So the kings of Canaan lost the battle. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah are fleeing the battlefield. Apparently they fall into these slime pits. And that's the end of them. Those that remain of their armies flee up into the mountains, either around Hebron to the south or perhaps around Bethel to the north. But they flee into the mountains to get away from this army of these kings from Mesopotamia. Verse 11, and they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their, what's that next word? It looks like it's spelled victuals, but we as good Southerners know the word, it's victuals. If you've ever watched Granny on the Hillbillies, you've heard her talk about having victuals. That's what the word literally is. It's victuals, it's food. By the way, this morning in the morning worship service, I talked about the importance of words, vocabulary, the power of words. You know, one of the things that has differentiated up until this generation, here where we live in the South from the rest of the country, is our vocabulary. And I know that they make fun of us for words we use and the way we pronounce things. They still do that. But here in the South, there's a reason that we use words like vittles, reckon, you all. It's because this is not just Dixie, this is the Bible Belt. And people historically here in the South have grown up with a King James Bible for the last 300 to 400 years, and they read their Bibles on a regular basis. And the language of the Bible was just an everyday part of people's lives growing up here in the South, in the Bible Belt. So there's a reason that we say vittles, that they make fun of us for using words like that, or reckon, or you all. One of Paul's favorite ways of addressing people in his epistles was you all. Well, that's what we say. We just abbreviate it to y'all, but that's short for you all. And so I simply point that out. There's a reason that folks in the South talk the way we do, use some of the words we use, so they can make fun of us all they want to. We ought to be proud of the fact that it's because our heritage is rooted in this book right here. But it says, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their victuals and went their way. So in other words, these kings of the east from Mesopotamia, they took everything there was to take, everything that wasn't nailed down that they wanted, they took with them, and they headed back to go home. Verse 12, and they took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So when they captured the city of Sodom, there was Lot living there with all his cattle and all the things he owned. Well, they just assumed he was like everybody else living in Sodom. They captured the city. They took him. They took his stuff just like they took everybody else's stuff. And it said they took Lot. Apparently, they were taking slaves, not just goods, not just livestock. They were taking slaves as well. They took Lot and departed. Verse 13. And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and these were confederate with Abram. So somebody from Sodom escaped. They went down and they ran across Abram down there near Hebron and said, listen, the city has fallen. Your nephew Lot was taken with all his stuff. And they've taken him and a whole bunch of other people, and they're heading back to Mesopotamia. They didn't call it Mesopotamia, but they're taking them, and they're heading home with them. They've taken your nephew as a slave. Verse 14, and when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, that says his brother, it's his nephew, but remember, Abram's already called him his brother. They're family, that's what he's saying. When Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them unto Dan. Now, 318. We do not know how many there were in the armies of these four kings from Mesopotamia. But I'm pretty sure it was a lot more than 318. It's kind of reminiscent of what we read about later in the book of Judges when somebody else has an army of 300. Gideon going up against an army of the Amalekites and their confederates of about 135,000 later on. I don't know that these four kings had 135,000, but they definitely had more than 318. So Abram is doing a very brave thing. In some ways, this is a stark contrast to the way he behaved when he went down to Egypt. When he went down to Egypt, he was worried about his own skin. Here, he's putting himself and all that he has at stake to go rescue Lot. I think we'd like to hope he's had a character change. Hopefully, he has. I think there's also a possibility that at this point, Abram still has no children of his own. Sarai is still barren. I think there's at least a possibility that Abram viewed Lot as being his seed, the one that God had said, I'm going to give all this to. Whether that's so or not, whether he perceived Lot as being that one that God had spoken of, he certainly is acting more like a man ought to act here than he was when we saw him down in Egypt. So he takes off with his band of 318 trained servants from his own household against this army that's taking all of the loot back home, as well as the slaves. He just takes off after them. It says he pursued them unto Dan. Now, this is one of those instances where we see an indication that very likely someone after Moses either changed the name that Moses had written in for whatever the place was to update it to the land known as the land given to the tribe of Dan later on when the children of Israel go in to possess the land. Or it could even be an indication that there are certain portions of the book of Genesis that were written by Joshua or someone else after Moses had already died. Nevertheless, this area up here to the north of Israel is where the tribe of Dan was after the children of Israel went in to possess the land. So he pursues them. They're going northward. It looks like what they're going to do is they're going to go northward and then go down between the two rivers. Perhaps that was just an easier journey than going across the wilderness here to the Euphrates. They were going to follow the Fertile Crescent that we have all heard about, learned about in world history class. It says here, though, verse 15, and he divided himself against them, he and his servants, by night, and smote them, and pursued them to Hobah, which is on the left hand of Damascus. So he pursues them all the way up to Damascus, Syria. He catches them at night, much the same way as Gideon with his 300, and he stays on them. I know one of my heroes is General Stonewall Jackson, and Stonewall Jackson, one of the quotes he's famous for is saying that a smaller army can defeat a larger army every time if they attack, and when the enemy begins to retreat, they continue to attack, and they stay on them. I'm paraphrasing what General Jackson said, but it's the same thing that General Jackson did in the Shenandoah Valley during the War of Northern Aggression. Every time he would defeat a Yankee army, he would stay on them. He wouldn't just let them retreat and regroup. He would stay on them, keep attacking till he just whittled them down and they just fled to get out of there. That's the same tactic that Abram is following as he's pursuing these armies as they head north to Damascus. Verse 16. And he brought back all the goods, that is Abram. He rescued them. He brought back all the goods and also brought again his brother Lot and his goods and the women also and the people. So all those people that had been taken from the cities of the plains as captives, Abram rescues all of them and gets back all the stuff, all the loot that had been taken. Verse 17. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. So the king of Sodom goes out to meet him. Now, here's Sodom. It's down here along the Jordan River, somewhere in the valley there, on the plains near Jordan. Abram is met by two people when he returns home. he's returning home with all those people that had been captured. He's bringing them back. He's bringing back all the stuff that had been stolen, bringing it back too. The two men that come out to meet him are the king of Sodom and the king of Salem. These are two very, very different men. And Abram has a totally different response for the two men. I want us to see this before we stop for tonight. Verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. And he was the priest of the Most High God. Now, we already know what Salem means, I think. What does the word, the name Salem, mean? Peace, that's right. If you've heard people talk about the peace of Israel or the peace of Jerusalem, the word Salem literally means peace. Well, the name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. King of righteousness. So here's the king of righteousness from the city of peace. He comes forth with bread and wine, and it says he was the priest of the Most High God. So here is a man, the king of Salem. Now, I know there are a couple of different ways of spelling his name in the Old and New Testament, so give me a pass if I didn't get it this one. Melchizedek, he is both the king and the priest. And, you know, you might say, well, he's there in this Amorite, this Canaanite city. He must be the priest of one of their gods, Baal, Ashtaroth, one of these other gods or goddesses. No, the Bible says he's the priest of the Most High God. That name, the Most High God, the Hebrew word is El Elyon. Means the God of gods. The Most High God. This is the same God that Abram worshipped. He's the same God that you and I worship. El Elohim. El Elyon. This king was also the high priest of the true and living God. Now we're going to talk a little bit about who this man Melchizedek is, might have been, in just a moment. But right now we just see he's both the king and the priest of the true and living God. Notice it says he brought forth bread and wine. I'm only going to throw this in quickly in passing. Those are also, by the way, the two elements that are used in the Lord's Supper. You know what they represent, the body and blood of the Lord Jesus and the sacrifice he made for our atonement. Verse 19, look what it says Melchizedek did when he came out to meet Abram. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." Now, it's God that's the possessor of heaven and earth, but he says, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God." He obviously worshiped the same God that Abram worshiped, and he blessed him. Now, there are only certain people that have the right to bless someone the way he's blessing Abram. In Scripture, the only time we see someone blessing someone else or giving someone a blessing is if that's a person in authority of some sort over the person they're blessing. In other words, the son would not bless the father, give a blessing to the father. He might be a blessing, but he wouldn't give a blessing to the father. A parishioner would not give a blessing to the priest. It'd be the other way around, right? So this man, who is both the king and the priest of the Most High, is blessing Abram. Verse 20, "And blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand." So Melchizedek is acknowledging that it was God who gave Abram this victory. And it says, "And he gave him tithes of all." Now, does this mean Melchizedek gave Abram tithes? No. It's the other way around. Abram gave Melchizedek tithes. It says tithes of all. I don't think it means of all that Abram owned. He gave him tithes of everything he had brought back. he gave him tithes. Now, did Abram owe anything to the king of Salem? No. He's not giving him taxes. He's not giving him something for the king of Salem joining him in the battle. Yeah, tribute. He's not doing that. He gives him, the Bible literally says, tithes. In other words, a tenth of everything he had brought back, he gave them to the king of Salem. This is worship. When you and I give tithes in the offering plate, that's part of our worship of the Lord. It's expected. By the way, this is before the Mosaic law required believers to give 10%. People who are believers are already tithing to the Lord in the Bible before the law was given on Mount Sinai, which I think is another reason that believers today ought to still give at least a tithe to the Lord, or perhaps above and beyond that, but at the very least a tithe, because the tithe is something believers have been giving since the Garden of Eden before the law, and we ought to do at least that much, perhaps more, after the law in the day and time in which we live. It was before the law. Some people say, well, I don't tithe because, they say today, I don't tithe when I go to church because that was part of the law in the Old Testament and we don't live under the law. Well, here's Abram. He didn't live under the law either. That was before the law. He's still tithing. All right, but let me continue on. That's just a side note here. But he tithes and he gives those tithes to Melchizedek. It's a form of worship when he gives those tithes. Now, let's continue on, verse 21. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods to thyself. So these are the two men that came out to meet him, the king of Salem and the king of Sodom. Now, the king of Sodom says, listen, thanks for bringing my people back. Kind of hard to be king of a city if there ain't no people in the city, I guess. He said, thanks for bringing my people back. He said, you keep all the stuff and just let my people come home. Look what Abram said, verse 22. And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lift up mine hand unto the Lord, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. In other words, he raised his hand in praise to God, taking an oath, verse 23, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou shouldest say, I have made Abram rich, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eskel, and Mamre, let them take their portion. Abram said, listen, to the king of Sodom, I don't want your stuff. I'm not taking your stuff. Even down to the shoestrings, I don't want your stuff. Because I don't want you to say that you made me rich. You see, I think here we see another example that Abram has matured a little bit. He's grown up a little bit. He could have done like he did when he left Egypt and said, yeah, I'll keep all the stuff. And he would have had more stuff. But what he's saying is, I want God, the possessor of heaven and earth, to get the credit for the victory. And to get the credit for making me the man that I am. I don't want the king of Sodom saying, I made Abram. I want everybody to look at me and say, look what the God of Abram made Abram. So he turned down his stuff. Boy, wouldn't it be great if Christians today could pull that stuff out of their pockets and say no to the world. I know we have to have money to pay the bills and do all that, but there are a lot of Christians today who are compromising for mammon, the almighty dollar. Wouldn't it be great if there were more Christians today that would say what Abram said? Keep your stuff. I don't want your stuff because I want God to get the credit for making me who I am. All right, now, I know my time is up. If you'll give me 5 more minutes, I promise I'll be through. Would you turn in your Bibles to the book of Hebrews, chapter number 7? Because before we leave this chapter, I want us to see some things about this man, Melchizedek, because I think it's one of the most exciting things there is to see in the book of Genesis. Now, I'm going to erase our map. Hopefully, you've made a mental picture of whatever you want to make a mental picture of. If not, Kim will come up here and redraw the map later on after we're through.
She took good notes.
I'm just joking. She makes comments about my map sometimes, but she wasn't giving me a hard time. All right, so Melchizedek, we see here that he is a king and a priest. He's the king of Salem, which means peace. We know that Jerusalem is referred to as the city of God throughout the rest of the Bible. The name Melchizedek means king of righteousness. Now, this man who comes out to meet Abram, Bible commentators that believe like you and I believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible, they fall into one of two categories as to who they think Melchizedek in Genesis 14 actually is. Some of them, men that I trust and respect, that I study behind when I'm preparing, some of them will say that the name Melchizedek is not the name of a man, but it is a title. That title, King of Righteousness, is simply the title for this particular person who was serving as the king of Salem at the time. The second view, though, is that, and so therefore he's just a man. The second view, though, is that this is a Christophany, or as we've called it before, a theophany. And what do we mean by these things? A manifestation of God. I like the way my Bible teacher said it in Bible college, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. An appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament before he had flesh in Bethlehem. All right, so it's a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. Now, I'm going to tell you before we read the passage in Hebrews and talk about it, your pastor's going to love you even if you disagree with the preacher. It doesn't matter to me which one you think that it is. This man has an important role. Whatever you think about who the man in Genesis 14 is, whether you think he was just a man doing the work of God or if he was actually God manifest in the appearance of a man before Abram. So, look at Hebrews chapter 7. The book of Hebrews, of course, compares the Old Covenant with the New Covenant, and that we as Christians are not under the Old Covenant, but under the New. What is the key word for the whole book of Hebrews? Somebody? Somebody's got to know this one. We've talked about it before. We haven't studied the book, but we've talked about it. The key word throughout the book of Hebrews is better, better, better. And Paul, or whoever the human author is that wrote the book, I think it was Paul myself, the human author is constantly saying what we have under the new covenant is better, better, better than what they had under the old covenant. One of the comparisons, or contrast rather, that is made is that our high priest under the new covenant is better than the high priests under the old covenant. The high priests under the old covenant were those who were the descendants of Aaron, the Aaronic priesthood. Who's our great high priest?
Jesus.
The book of Hebrews tells us in this chapter we're about to read, the first 10 verses, Jesus is not a priest after the order of Aaron. All the priests of the Aaronic priesthood were men, were mortals, had sins of their own that they had to tend to before they tended to the business of everybody else's. But Jesus is different. Jesus is not a priest after the order of Aaron, but after the order of Melchizedek. Look what it says, Hebrews 7, verse 1. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Look at verse 3. Without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. Now consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. And verily, they that are of the sons of Levi, that's Aaron, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descent is not counted from them received tithes of Abraham and blessed him that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. And here men that die receive tithes. That's talking about the descendants of Aaron. But there he receiveth them, receiveth tithes, of whom it is written, it is witnessed that he liveth. And as I may so say, Levi also, who receiveth the tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. So the human author of Hebrews is saying, listen, Melchizedek is a different kind of high priest than all the sons of Aaron that have been priests for hundreds of years. They all had sins of their own. They were all mortal men. Yes, they received tithes from their brethren, from the others of the children of Israel. But even these priests, the sons of Aaron, the sons of Levi, the tribe of Levi, they paid their tithes also. They paid their tithes to this man. Who did the priests of Aaron pay their tithes to? This man, Melchizedek. You say, Levi wasn't even born then. Aaron wasn't even born then. What the writer of Hebrews says is, they paid tithes to Melchizedek when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, because they were still in the loins of Abraham and had not been born yet. But when Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, so did the priests of Aaron. Now, there are some who would say that verse 3, when it says, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, they would say this first argument, that the king of Salem was just a type or a picture of Jesus that would come later. And it is true, throughout the Old Testament, there are individuals that are types or pictures, shadows, foreshadowing Jesus and other things that would happen. But I'll be honest with you, your pastor feels like, after reading Hebrews 7, this king of Salem, Melchizedek, that came out to meet Abram, I don't think he was just a man that was a type or a picture of Jesus. Your pastor thinks that this was actually Jesus appearing to Abram. When it says, without father or mother, without descent, neither beginning of days nor end of days, that sounds a whole lot like the way Jesus is described in the book of Revelation. And so, you can believe whichever you want to believe. Not going to hurt the preacher's feelings either way, by the way. But this was either a king and priest that was a type and a picture of Jesus to come, or this was a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus in the Old Testament before he was ever born in Bethlehem. All right, now that brings us to the end of our Bible study for tonight. You've given me almost 20 extra minutes. Thank you for letting me go over tonight. But we covered two whole chapters tonight, so we made good time. Is there anyone that has a question or a comment about Melchizedek or anything else that we've talked about tonight.